And we're holding in Chinese page Mem Gimel Oys Zayin. Previous Mishnah had talked about from when we start mentioning rain and asking for rain, meaning Machshavah Ruach Moed Geshem and Masein Talamotah respectively. So now the Mishnah says Ad Emasai Sholem Sag Shomim. Up to what point in the year do we ask for rain? Do we say Masein Talamotah? Rabbi Yehuda Imadshe Yavra Pesach. Rabbi Yehuda says until Pesach is over. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Meir, Omer, Ad Sheyetzeh Nissen. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Meir says until Nissen is over. Now, the halacha is actually not like either one of those, because, of course, we stop on the first day of Pesach. The Gemara explains there are other opinions that are not mentioned in the Mishnah over here that we follow one of them. Anyway, why does Rabbi Yossi or Rabbi Meir say that we should be saying the same Talmud until Nissen is over? When usually the point is in Eretz Yisrael, usually the last rains fall in early Nisan, and by the time you don't usually expect that later in the month it's still going to rain. Shenema, as we actually find the pasuk where that describes rain falling a substantial amount of rain falling in Nisan. By Yodah Lachem Geshem, Navi says Hashem brought down for you rain. Yo Moda Umalkush, the Moda, which in Krishma we say Yodah Umalkush, here it's Moda instead, which means basically the same thing. Umalkush, Yodah is the Moda, Yodah is the early rain, which usually comes Cheshvan time. Umalkush and the later rain, which usually comes Nisan time. Barishain, they both came in the first month, meaning in Nisan, which the Gemara is going to tell us what the story was over here. So therefore, so Rabbi Yossi or Rabbi Meir is saying that shows that Nisan is a valid time for the Moda or the Yoda and the Malkush, and therefore that's reasonable to be asking for rain until Nisan is over. Marsha points out, so why is Yoel calling it over here Moda instead of Yoda? So one thing is, with you in the same pasuk, he says that Hashem gave you the Moda for tzedakah, where Moda actually has a double meaning. It means the early rain, like we're saying. It also means a teacher that Hashem sent them, Nevi'im, to teach them the right thing to do tshuva, to be for the famine that we're going to describe now in the Gemara to be over, and therefore now also he continues in the same vein in the pasuk and calls this early rain mode. So Amalei Rav Nachman l'Rabbi Yitzchak Yoda b'Nissan who? Since when does the Yoda come in Nissan? Yoda b'mach cheshvan who? The Yoda is supposed to be doing cheshvan time. The Tanan, the Tanya, really, it's a Braisa. We learn in a Braisa. Yoda b'mach cheshvan or Malkush b'nissen. The Yoda is supposed to be in cheshvan. That's the first rains of the season. And the Malkush, it takes place in Nissan. Those are the last rains of the season. The Gemara brings in this connection why it's called Malkush. But in any case, the point is that why is the Navi mentioning them both coming in the first month, meaning in Nisan? Now there are Mefoshim who explain that the word Barishon can mean that Hashem brought them from the beginning, like that year had been a drought, and then Hashem brought them as a new thing that the last year or the last couple of years you hadn't had it, and now Hashem is starting to bring it again. And so they understand Barishon meaning not in the sense of the first month, but rather the first time for a while. But Gemara is understanding that it literally means the first month. So what are we talking about? Amalei, so Rabbi Yitzchok answers him, Hochi Amar Rabbi Yechon. Rabbi Yechon explained, Bimei Yoyel ben Pesuel Niskayim Mikrozeh. What happened in this pasuk came true in the times of Yoyel ben Pesuel. So Yoyel was one of the Terei Aser. He's the second of the Terei Aser. Now the Gemara is understanding over here that he lived in the times of Elisha. Now there are actually a number of different opinions when he lived. There is, the Rashi brings on the Pesukim over there, that a Medrash, that he was actually a son of Shmuel Anavi, which would make him fairly early. The Medrash brings that he's called, so now there is, it does mention, in Sefer Shmuel, it mentions that Shmuel had two sons, one of whom was named Yoel, and the Pesuk says negative things about them. The Pesuk says they took bribes and perverted justice. Famously, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos they didn't actually do that, but they stayed put in their place and demanded that people come to them, and they asked people to give them maaserishon and things like that, unlike what Shmuel did. So therefore, the pasuk speaks badly of them. But nevertheless, according to that, then he did tshuva and he eventually became a novel. The interesting thing, why he's called Ben Pesuel, then, is either because Pesuel means Shapita Lakeo, like he, so to speak, talked Hashem into doing good for the Jewish people, as we find that Shmuel did, davening on behalf of the Jewish people, or because the word Pesuel is similar to the word Besula, and Shmuel, we know the Mishnah tells us at the end of Nazir that according to one opinion he would that he would that, that at the end of Masechta Nazir the Mishnah brings one opinion that he was a Nazir, that when Chana says on him a murder loyal arosh, it means that she's declaring that he's going to be a Nazir. So therefore, he was in a sense like a basula, like a young girl who lets her hair grow long and curls it, and whatever. So Shmuel was like that as well, and therefore he's called Pesuel, and therefore according to that, his son is called Yoel. So you have an opinion that he was a son of Shmuel. Here you have the Gemara is taking that he was in the times of that he was in the times of Elisha, and there's actually yet another Mandomer that says that he lived much later in the times of Menashe Melech Yehuda. In Seder Olam, it says there were a number of Nevi'im in the times of Menashe Melech Yehuda, and the Torah, usually the Pasuk identifies a Navi by what kings ruled during his times, but in the case of Yoel and a couple of the other Nevi'im, Nachum was another one, there's a couple of others, where it doesn't, because since Menashe was such a Rasha, the Pasuk doesn't want to associate his name with the Nevi'im. So there are different opinions, and in fact, the Rambam seems to follow that, because the Rambam, when he brings in at the beginning of Yad HaChazaka, when he brings the Seder of the Masoda, generation after generation, from Moshe Rabbeinu down to Rav Ashi, so he puts Yoel in that period of Menashe, approximately. He makes him a couple of generations after Yeshayah. So that's what I'm saying. So you have three different opinions. So Menashe lived. So Menashe was king almost for like 350 years after Shmuel. So in short, you have three different opinions when the Navi Yoel lived. He was a son of Shmuel, which would place him approximately in the times of David HaMelech, of David and Shlomo. You have that he was in the times of Elisha, which would be about 100 years later, or that he was in the times of Menashe, which would be another 200 years after. Be that as it may, all Gemara is taking the view that he lived in the time of Elisha. So now, like Stichtibay, Yoel begins his nevuah by describing a terrible plague of locusts that hit Eretz Yisrael. Yeser ha-gozam ochel ha-arbe, whatever was left by the gozam, which is one type of locust, the arbe ate, the yeser arbe, and whatever the arbe left over, ochel ha-yelek, then the yelek ate. The yeser ha-yelek, ochel ha-chosel. So every year, there was a different type of locust that invaded Eretz Yisrael 4 years in succession over there, and by the time all that was done, there was very little left. Rashi, by the way, mentions on the Pasuk in Parshas Bo, when it says about the Arba of Mitzrayim, Ba'achor of Lo Yikain, there will never again be a plague of locusts like the one that hit Mitzrayim. The difference is, Rashi says over there, because there in Mitzrayim, it was only one species. Here we're saying it was different species year after year. Of what description?
That it was one species. What would that
mean? So the point is, in other words, that made usually one species. Here we're saying, for example, it took one species after another to completely devastate Eretz Yisrael. But here we're saying, by Mitzrayim, that wasn't even necessary. Hashem brought only one species, and it only lasted a week, and everything's gone. Rashi mentions now what it is the Gemara is soon going to point. The Gemara is soon going to refer to a famine that it says was in the times of Elisha that lasted 7 years. So now the Gemara is understanding that the 4 years of locusts that happened in Yoel's times are part of those 7 years of famine that Elisha had predicted. So now, finally, when the 4 years of that are over, Oisa Shona Yotza Adar V'Yodug Shamim. So now, Adar was already over and rain hadn't fallen yet. So now they had everything, all the crops had been eaten by locusts for the last few years. And now on top of that, there had been a drought as well. And now it's halfway through the year where normally, again, the rain should start falling in Cheshvan. And already Adar is over and rain hadn't started falling yet. Yodalham Revere Rishon and Be'echa B'Nissan. The first rain of that year fell on Rosh Chodesh Nissan. Why did it first then? Marsha points out, because Rosh Chodesh Nissan already is the beginning of a new year for certain purposes. So now Hashem had decided there's going to be 7 years of famine. Now the 7 years can be said to be over once Adar is over and Rosh Chodesh Nissan is already the beginning of a year as far as Malachim and Regal. Amalehem Novi Yisrael Tzu Viziru. So Yoel tells the Jewish people of his times, go and plant. Now that Hashem is sending rain, now you can go and plant. He also describes, Yoel describes at great length over there how everybody gathered together and cried in the Bis Mikdash and did Shuvah, and how Hashem said, fine, I'm getting rid of the locusts once and for all, and they're not going to bother you again, etc. So now, as part of this also, the Navi is telling them, now that all that is over, it's time to plant. Omruloi, so they asked him, Mishi Yeshle Kav Chitim, a Kabayim Sorim. So what is a person supposed to do if he only has left a kav of wheat or two kav of barley? Yechlenu v'yichya, should he eat it and he's going to survive off that? He's going to live off that. Or Yisra'enu b'karka v'yomu, so if he plants it on the ground, what's he going to have to eat? But until it takes months for grain to grow, what's he going to eat meanwhile? Omalahem, so Yoel tells them, Afapikan Siru Tsuubaziru. So Tsuziru. He tells them, nevertheless, trust in Hashem and go plant. So Yotsu Vizoru, so sure enough, they went and planted. Vinasalahem Ness, and now a Ness happened for them. Vinisgalahem Mashabak Solim, or Mashabas Dokum, or Mashabachodin Molim. Now all of a sudden they discovered grain that was hidden in the walls that ants or mice or whatever had hidden away in the walls, or Mashabas Dokim and cracks, or Mashabachodin Molim, and in the ant hills, they discovered a whole bunch more of grain. So now having planted their grain, they have what to live off for the next while until the grain grows. In fact, the Rif makes the point that only after they planted, only then did Hashem help them find what was in the holes and the cracks and whatnot. The Rif over here makes the point because Hashem wanted to see that first they have that bitochen, that they're going to listen to the Navi. On the face of it, they have a point. I mean, what are they going to live off of meanwhile? But they still had bitochen. The Navi knows what he's talking about, and they went and planted anyway. So now the Eibishter rewarded their bitochen on the spot. By now they have enough grain to live on for the next little while. And Anaf Yosef makes another point as well. If they had found it, there's a din in that connection, in connection with the halachas of leket shitchan peya. When you find grain in ant hills, does it belong to you or does it belong to the aniyim? Because you assume that the ants took it from leket, which belongs to the poor people. Well, if they were to find what's in the ant hills before they go and plant, then they have enough grain on hand that they're not poor. They would have to give it to the poor people. So like this, they planted it first. Now they're as poor as possible. Now if they find grain in the ant hills, they themselves can take it because now they themselves are poor and they can legitimately take leket. Anyway. So Yotzu Rizoru B'Sheni U'Shlishi U'Ravi. So they went and planted on the second, third, and fourth of Nisan. Yodalam Ravi Ashniya B'Chamishi B'Nisan. And then the second rain fell on the fifth of Nisan. Usually the Gemara points out a little later in the Perek that usually the first and second Raviya are later on in the Perek, the Gemara explains why it's called Raviya. The word Raviya is actually related to a word for having relations, like Omispar Asiroiva Yisrael and other such expressions, because, so to speak, like you have when rain falls on the earth, that's like a husband and wife getting together and having relations so that children will be produced in the same way the rain does that for the earth. Apikabala, we have the idea that the earth is Malchus and rain comes from Zah. So when Zah and Malchus get together, then you have great things happen. Anyway, so therefore the rain is called Revia. And later on in the Perek, the Gemara explains that usually the first and second Revia happen about a week or two apart. There's a few different opinions later on in the Perek. Is it that the first Revia is usually around the third of Cheshvan and the second one around the seventh, and then there's a third one around the 17th, or was it 17, 23, and Rosh Chodesh and Rosh Chodesh Kislev? A couple of different opinions. So here you have the two Revias came, the first Revia and the second Revia came 4 days apart, Rosh Chodesh Nisan and the fifth of Nisan. The Krivu Oma B'Shisha Asav Nisan. Now the grain grew so fast that they were able to bring the Korban Oma from the barley that grew on the 16th of Nisan. Nimtze Satvua Hagdela B'Shisha Chadoshim Gdela Ba'Achad Asayim. So normally grain, now barley, fine, barley grows faster, but wheat at least usually takes around 6 months to grow, because usually you plant wheat around Tishrei time. Marsha points out, okay, there are actually different opinions about that in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which is going to be in a couple of weeks in Daf Hayomi. Anyway, there's different opinions over there about exactly when the time of planting is, whether it's in Tishrei or in Cheshvan, but whatever, it's sometime around that time of year that you plant the wheat. And it's usually ready for harvesting beginning around Nisan time. So usually it takes around 6 months. Here, it took only 11 days. The nimtza omer akarav mitzvor shel shisha chadashim, the omer, which usually comes from grain of the type that normally would take 6 months to grow, karav mitzvor shel yud alef yom, then again it was brought from grain that had grown in only 11 days. Strictly speaking, actually, the grain for the omer doesn't usually take 6 months to grow. Again, the grain for the omer is barley, and barley has a much faster growth cycle than wheat. In fact, the Gemara tells us in Menachos that they would plant the barley for the omer 70 days before Pesach, and that would be enough time for it to grow. So when the Gemara says over here, Agdela b'shisha chadashim, it's kind of using it loosely. In other words, that among the various kinds of grains, one of which is used for the korban omer, some of them take as much as 6 months to grow, and here it took only 11 days. Tosfos actually wonders, why are we saying dafka 11 days? If we're saying that they planted on the second, the third, and the fourth, then that means some of it grew in, and then they're harvesting it on the 16th. Some of it took 14 days to grow. Some of it took 13 days to grow. Why are we saying as a blanket statement that all of it took 11 days to grow? Marshall explains, because based on the continuation of the Gemara, that what it is that when we're saying the Revi'a Shnia rained on the 5th of Nisan, what they planted on the second, third, and fourth did not start germinating yet, did not start taking root in the ground and starting to grow until that second Revi'a came. So some of it was sitting in the ground for as much as 3 days until that second Revi'a came. When it came on the fifth, then all of that planting that they had done the previous 3 days now started germinating and now started growing and developing roots and stalks and whatnot. So therefore, the Gemara can validly say that all of it took only 11 days, because even the ones that were planted on Beis and Gimel only started, and Dalad, all of them only started growing on hay when that second rain fell. So Val Oisa Dur Hu Omer, it's about that generation, about what happened to them, this nest that Hashem did for them in the schus of the tshuva, the tremendous outpouring of tshuva they did. Agav, by the way, you can find parts of the story in Yoel are printed in Chumashim. You have the Haftorah of Shabbos tshuva. We do the section Shuva Yisrael from the end of Hosea. But in the Velt, they also do a section from Sefer Yoel, which is part of the story where everybody's doing tshuva, and then Vayikane Hashem la'amei vayachma la'artzei, and Hashem says, I'm going to give you, and it quotes this pasuk in that section of that Haftorah, Vayod Lachem Geshem Moro Malkush Perdition. So in other words, so in the Velt, they read it because it talks about a tremendous outpouring of tshuva that they did at that time, and the Eibishter reciprocates with these openness. Anyway. About that generation, the Pasuk says, "Has zodim bedima, those who plant, those who sow their grain with tears, and they're in tears because they don't know what they're going to eat." As we said, they asked the Novi, what are we supposed to eat while the grain is growing? They didn't know yet there's going to be a nest and it's going to be ready in only 11 days. And even if, yeah, you still need what to eat in 11 days. So they're planting. Yes, they have betochen, but they're still crying about that. They're still nervous. They will harvest with songs of joy when all of a sudden this nest happened and they're able to harvest only 11 days later. Then there's this outpouring of joy. And the pasuk continues, they go along crying, while they're carrying the burden of the zera. The word meshach hazara can mean the bag in which they have the seeds. It can mean during the time. The Gemara is going to take it in the sense of during the time that it takes to that it takes for the grain to grow. Meshach, like a meshach zman. So my holich yevuch uvacha noise meshach hazara. So what does that pasuk mean? Meaning, in other words, what is that pasuk adding? Since already you have the previous pasuk hazara medima b'rinu tzeru. So what is the pasuk holich yevuch uvacha adding to that? So Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, sure, that second pasuk refers not to the person who's sowing the seeds, but rather to the animal. One of the common ways they had of planting seeds in those times was you would hitch up a wagon to an ox or something. You'd put the seeds in the wagon. You'd have little holes in the bottom of the wagon, and as the animal is walking along on the plowed field, then the seeds would fall out through the holes over there, and then you can scatter. Then you can broadcast the seeds very, very quickly over a large area. So the shur is busy doing that. And the shur is also, the shur has to plow first in order before you use it for planting. So shur, the ox, when it's going to plow, then it's crying also. The animals are short on food as well. And by the time the animal is returning back from plowing a furrow in the field, then already it's able to eat young shoots of the plants from the furrow that it just plowed. In other words, now that they planted, as soon as they planted, it started growing, and therefore already you have young tender greenery from it that the animals can already eat. And therefore now even the animal is happy. That's what the pasuk means, that he will come with happiness. So not just the people were happy, but even the animals were happy. So Marshall explains that's what when we say when we what we're talking about is that again that when they planted the seeds on the second, third, and fourth of Nisan, nothing's growing yet. It only started growing after the second Revi'ah. Now, what happens is you often have when it comes to plowing, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, where a lot of the soil is kind of hard and rocky. It's very common. The Gemara mentions in some places you would plow before the rains and also after them. Because afterwards, after the ground is wetter, then it's easier to plow, and then you can open it up more, and then the seeds will grow better in the ground. So here we're talking about that second plowing after the rain falls, and immediately, therefore, b'derech nes, we're saying the grain started growing so quickly that by the time the animal is finished plowing a furrow in the field, already there's chazes, already there's greenery growing from it, and they're able to see, and they're able to eat. So that's zeb bo yavibirin. My noisal moisav. What about the last part of the pasuk? What about the last pasuk carrying his sheaves of grain? So Rashi's gear says actually my boy yavibirina noisal moisav. The Gemara is asking about the whole last half of the pasuk. He's going to come with songs of joy carrying his sheaves. What's the chiddush if we're saying already birina yiktzodu? Then of course when they gather their sheaves, they're going to be very happy. What is the pasuk adding by that? Tosfos explains that rather the question is what's alumoy sub in the plural? And Marashos explains similarly what's alumoy sub in the plural. So Omer of Chista, Va'amilav Masnei Satana, Rav Chista says, or some say we learned in a brisa, Oisa Shana Kone Zeres Vishibolas Zrasayim Hoya. That year, now normally when you have a stalk of grain, usually the stalk is fairly tall, and then at the top of it you have the area over there with the seeds, the actual sheaf of grain. Here a nest happened, and the grain grew. The stalk is only a zeres in size, a zeres being a half an amma, so somewhere between about 9 and 12 inches. And the shibolus, the area that has the seeds, is zrasayim, is twice that size. So unlike a normal stalk of grain, where the shibolus is only a small fraction of the whole height, here it's the other way around. 2/3 of the height of the total stalk consisted of the area with the kernels, which means, in other words, that each plant. Each individual plant that's growing from the seeds is putting much more of its energy into producing seeds, and therefore they have a lot more edible food for per base core or per base saw or however you want to define it exactly. So that was part of the nest also that they have. So in other words, it wasn't even regular alumois. It was alumois sub. It was their special alumois that they had that year that have an unusually large proportion of grain to straw. So that was part of the nest also. This is, by the way, you know, that Amma mentions in Hilchos Teshuvah that you have a person who's done averus and Hashem is disgusted with him and wants very little to do with him, etc. And then all of a sudden the person does teshuvah and now all of a sudden becomes v'chov v'nechmad, etc. And the Eibishta loves him. So this is an example of that Yoel is to begin with telling them why is all this happening because of averus the Jewish people have been doing. Now they did such a tremendous degree of teshuvah that now all of a sudden the Eibishta is tuning things 180 degrees and showing them all these open nisim that would never happen at any normal time. So the Gemara continues. My dichtiv. Now, what does it say in this connection? Now, again, according to Rashi, we're talking about the same famine over here. First, we were talking about the 4 years of locusts in the times of Yoyo, and now we're going to talk about the 7 years in the times of Elisha, which, according to Rashi, are part and parcel of the same thing. The 7 years of Elisha include the 4 years of locusts that Yoyo will say. Not all, now again, since we said before, there were different opinions. When Yoel lived, then not all Mephoshim agree that they are the same thing. So according to those other Mephoshim, then the Gemara is asking a separate question. Having talked about the famine of Yoel's time, so now the Gemara is digressing to talk about the famine of Elisha's times. So my dichtiv, the Pasuk says, Ki kora Hashem l'ra'av, Hashem has called to the famine, as if like famine can be personified as something like Hashem can call to. And it's come to the land for 7 years. The context is this is in the times of Yehoram ben Achav, one of the kings of Yehuda, who of Yisrael rather. Like most of the kings of Yisrael, he was a Rosha. And so now you have the Pasuk describes, so you have the story of Elisha reviving the son of the Isha Shunamis, where he had told her, he had promised her she's going to have a baby, and then the baby has sunstroke, the child has sunstroke and passes away, and Elisha is Machayim Mesim. Now, a few prokim later, the Pasuk says, Elisha tells this woman and her family, there's going to be a coming of famine in Eretz Yisrael for 7 years, so you should leave Eretz Yisrael and go someplace else where you'll be able to live more comfortably. And he says there's going to be a famine for 7 years. The upshot, by the way, is the Pasuk mentions when she came back after 7 years, she found other people had taken over her house and her field, and she came to complain to the king to get them back. And the king just then is talking with Gehazi, and Gehazi is telling him all the nisim that Elisha did, including just then she comes, and Gehazi says, hey, that's that woman who Elisha revived her son. And so the king hears her out and has somebody make sure that she gets everything back. Incidentally, by the way, the Pasuk mentions that the king says, make sure she gets back her house and her field and all of the produce of the field during all these last years. Now, what about there should also be rental for the house? Shouldn't there be rental income for the house as well for those 7 years? Both the Rabag and Malbim on the Pasuk make an interesting point. La halacha, you have a concept that hador b'chatzar chaveda shalei b'chinam. Sometimes you have that when somebody else lives in your chotzer without permission, where it's a case where you're not ordinarily renting out that chotzer to anybody else, and the person themselves doesn't normally need to rent one because they have someplace else to live, they're not obligated to pay you rent. It's called zenen of zelei chotzer. So we see in this pasuk an example of that. Since that house was not something that she was planning to rent out, and the people who were squatting in it weren't ones who normally would have needed to rent someplace else, al pi halacha, therefore she's taken not entitled to rent the back rent for those 7 years, and therefore you heard him. As much as he was a rasha, he knew the halacha, and therefore he's not saying that she should get that back. But the produce of the field is something else that she's entitled to get reimbursed for that. Anyway. So the pasuk is saying that there's going to be a famine for 7 years. So the question is, b'hanach zayin shnin, my ochel, what do they eat during those 7 years? Which there's two ways of explaining the question. In other words, it can be that we're asking so Eitz Yosef points out one way of understanding the question is. So Marashur explains like this. We have many times, there are a number of famines that are described in Tanakh. In fact, Targum at the beginning of Megillas Rus mentions 10 famines in history. But you never find that they actually lasted 7 years. For example, even the one of Yaakov and Yosef's times didn't end up lasting 7 years. It lasted for 2 years, and then Yaakov and his family came to Mitzrayim, and it stopped. Here we're saying, implying that it actually happened. There really was a famine for 7 years straight. So what were they eating? Didn't they long run out of food long since before that? So Eitz Yosef explains a little bit of the question is a little bit different. The question can be, what's this expression? The gam bo ela oretz sheva shonim. Just say, kikor ha'ashem l'rav sheva shonim, or something like that. So what it means is that that within those 7 years, each year is going to be a worse kind of famine than the previous one. So how did it work out exactly? What exactly happened during those 7 years? The first year, they ate what they had left in their houses. They still had grain stored up from the previous year, so they were able to live off that. The second year, they ate what was available in the fields and in the vineyards. Meaning, it can be, Rashi says, what was left over in the field. Sometimes you forget to harvest everything and you leave something behind. So therefore, they could eat that. Or it could mean svichim, like we have in last week's parasha, svich tzilchol esikzer. You have aftergrowths you have in the field. You have seeds of grain or other things like that fall during the harvest. And then the next year in the ground, they germinate and produce plants. So therefore, they were able to live off that. And that was the second year. Shlishis b'sar behema tahora. During the third year, they're out of grain and fruit or whatever. So therefore, they had to eat. So therefore, they were eating the meat of the kosher animals that they had. Revius, by the fourth year already, they're gone. That's gone. B'sar behema tmeya. Now they're reduced to eating non-kosher animals. You actually have the psukim describe earlier than that, so can describe a famine that was taking place in the city of Shomron, where there were two things also. There was a famine, and on top of that, there was a siege by the army of Aram. And at one point, it mentions things had gotten so bad that people are buying even a donkey to eat for an enormous amount of money, for 80 shekel, because they had nothing better available to eat. So that was during the fourth year. During the fifth year, they're down to eating shkotzim uramasim, where they're, at least behemoth tmei are fine. You know, you have these are something that many goyim in the world eat, and a person they're not so disgusting. Shkotzim uramasim is something that a person would really have to be in desperate straits to eat. In the sixth year, they're already down to eating their children. As we actually find, first of all, we have in the Teuchacha in this week's Parashah, but you have the Psukim in Malachim also describe over there how during that siege / famine that was going on in Shomron, there was a point when people were reduced to eating their children. And the Psukim describe over there how a woman one time yells and calls on Yehoram to help her. She says that I made a deal with my neighbor that we're going to eat my son today and your son tomorrow. And now she's hiding her son and she doesn't want to give him up. That's how bad things had gone. The pastors, we can imagine that they were dead, but maybe even not. I mean, maybe, yeah. Anyway, Maushah points out, the fact is, we did say before, assuming again, as Rashi does, that it was the same famine, we said even at the end of it, there still were some people, around a kav or two kavim of wheat or barley left. So it's not like everybody is down to eating their children, but at least there were some people who were reduced to that. By the way, in the Teuchacha, you know, when we have the expression of "Va'achaltem sabneichem of sabneisechem techelu," you know, it says worth mentioning a vort on the Teuchacha. You know, famously, it says that everything in the Teuchacha is really a hidden bracha. They say a vort on it that the bracha in that pasuk is that your children will be shomer a Torah mitzvah, as you are. "Va'achaltem sabneichem," you'll be able to, you a frum parent will be able to eat the meat that your sons or your daughters are serving you, and you won't have to worry about the kashrus of it. So the Gemara continues. Shvius b'sauzra is saying, in the seventh year, they were eating their own arms, which it's a strange thing. A person would eat their own arm. Iyun Yaakov says doesn't literally mean that. It means, in other words, that they were so thin, they were basically like living off their stored reserves in their bodies. So therefore, like their arms are wasting away and getting thinner because their body is consuming basically their is just consuming itself in order to have energy to stay alive. This fulfills like what it says in a pasuk, where again a Novi in a later time, Shaya, describes how there's going to come a point where people are going to be eating their own arms. So that happened during the seventh year of his famine. So that's what it means, therefore, that each one was worse than the previous year. And in that sense also we have therefore so therefore that also fits with what we were saying before, that it was that it intersects with the 4 years of the locusts. So like this, you know, you have in this week's Pirkei Avos, we have Rav Shabbat Sodas and Rav Shalmahuma. We have a different degrees of famine, where there can be Rav Shabbat Sodas, where there's a drought and therefore prices are higher than normal, and therefore you can have a Rav Shalmahuma, which is like this total confusion and everybody is like desperate for any scrap of food. So that's what we're describing the last years of this famine. That's how it was. By the way, when Maharshal mentions that in Targum and Megillas Rus, it mentions all the famines that are mentioned in Tanakh and history, there's one of them, which famously, where the Novi almost says, the famous song with the words of it, that there's going to be Rav Ba'aretz, Lo Rav La'lechem, like Soma La'mayim. There's going to come a point when there's not going to be a hunger and a thirst for physical food and drink. Kim the Shmoyas Divrei Hashem. So that's one of the famines, that there comes a point when we're not desperate for food and drink, but we're desperate for the Divrei Hashem. Okay, so now that the Gemara has brought a couple of questions that Rab Nachman asked Rab Yitzchak, so now the Gemara continues and digresses further with more questions that Rab Nachman asked Rab Yitzchak and Rab Yitzchak's answers to them. Each one where Rab Yitzchak, with the first few of them, Rab Yitzchak is giving him an answer in the name of Rab Yoch. So V'omalei Rab Nachman Rab Yitzchak. My dichtiv, the posit says, B'kirbacha Kodesh, among you is the holy, v'loy ovoy be'ir, and I will not come into the city. Now, what does that mean? Mishum de bekirba hakadosh, because there's holiness among you, light of a beer, therefore I'm not going to come into the city. Isn't that backwards? If there's kedusha among you, that's all the more reason that Hashem should come into the city of Yerushalayim and have his shechina rest over there. Now, you could say on pshat levels, there are possibilities. Some mefoshim on the pasuk say that Be'ir means other cities, meaning Hashem is saying, I'm not going to make my shechina rest in any other city, only in Yerushalayim. Tosfos brings over here, and some mefoshim on the pasuk also say, the word Be'ir can also mean in anger. We sometimes find where the word ear means like an enemy. So Hashem is saying, I won't come as an enemy, but rather as a friend. But here, the Gemara is understanding, Be'ir means in the city of Yerushalayim. So what does it mean? Amalei, so Rabbi Yitzchak answers, Hachi, Amar Rabbi Yechanan, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Loi Oveb Yerushalayim Shal Maila, Ad She Oveb Yerushalayim Shal Mata. I will not come into the Yerushalayim that is up above in Shamayim until I'm able to come into the Yerushalayim here on earth. So Rashi says, in other words, so the Pasuk is saying, until Bekir B'Chakadosh, until then, Loi Oveb Be'ir, I will not come into the city of Yerushalayim up above. That's according to Rashi. Marsha learns it a little differently. He says that the pasuk is like, you know, as a rhetorical question. If Kodesh B'Kirbacha, if you have holiness among you in Yerushalayim Shalmata, isn't it appropriate that I should come into the Yerushalayim Shalamayla? Meaning, but in other words, until then it can't be that. So you ask him, Mi'ika Yerushalayim Lamayla, is there such a thing as a Yerushalayim up above? And the answer is Ein. Dichtiv, as the pasuk says, Yerushalayim Habnuya, Yerushalayim which is built down here on earth, Ki'ir Shechubra Lo Yachdav, like the city that is joined together, meaning it's joined together, it's partnered. It's like you have this concept of sister cities. So the sister city of Yerushalayim Shalmata is Yerushalayim, is another Yerushalayim. And where would that other Yerushalayim be if not Lamayla? Therefore, so we see from that there has to be a Yerushalayim Shalmayla, and that's what we're saying, that Hashem is saying, I'm not going into there, I'm not going to be comfortable, so to speak, there, as long as I can't come into Yerushalayim Shalmata. We talk about that Yerushalayim is Mechuvenes Keneged Shaar HaShamayim, that it's opposite the gates of Shamayim, as Yaakov says during his dream. So that's what it means, in other words. And Yon Yaakov points out, it connects with the point of Ima and Nechibitzara, like we learned at the end of Megillah, Kol Mokum Shegolu, Shechina Imam. So the same way Hashem is saying, until the Beis Hamikdash is built down here, and I can make my Shechina rest in that, until then I'm not going to come and be comfortable in the Yerushalayim Shalmaila. So therefore, that's kind of a guarantee that's Hashem's guarantee that there will be a Yerushalayim Shalmata, and there will be Ashuras Hashechina over there. In Chassidus, it talks about that you have your Shalayim Shalmata and your Shalayim Shalmaila. Your Shalayim is Yira Shalayim, so you have Yira Tata and Yira Ilah. So as long as there's not a complete Yira Tata, then there can't be Yira Ilah, and all kinds of explanations based on that. You want to continue? So Amalei Rav Nachman Rav Yitzchak, my dichtiv, the pasuk says, over achas yivaru v'yichsalu, there's one thing with which the goyim are stupid and foolish. Musar havolim etu. The musar of wood, the musar of foolishness is wood. Now, on the face of it, Rashi explains, it means, in other words, the pasuk is saying they're like wood. They're insensitive to anything that a Navi would tell them, and therefore here I'm giving them musar, and it's all for nothing, because what good does it do to give musar to a block of wood? But what he's asking is that really what it means? Amalei, so sort of Yitzchak answers him, Hochi, Amar Rabbi Yechanan, Achasishim Va'eres Rishoyim Gehenim. Means there's one particular Aveira where it causes the Rishoyim to be burnt up in Gehen. In other words, we're saying the word Yivaru on the face of it means like Bani Bar V'la'eda, means foolish or stupid or whatever. But here you have an understanding, Meloshin Be'era, V'shilachas Be'era, Meloshin Shalom Shalom, Amaveras HaBe'era, that it means burning. There's one particular Aveira that causes the Rishoyim to be burnt up in Gehenem, Ma'ihi Avodah Zarah, namely Avodah Zarah. And where do we see the Pasuk is referring to Avodah Zarah? Ksiv Hocha Musar HaVolim Eitzvu. Here the Pasuk is mentioning the word HaVolim and saying that it's only wood. Uchtivasim Hevel Hema Masa Tatuim. Another Pasuk, also in Yirmiyah, or in the same Perek, actually says, That's foolishness. It's something masitatruim. It's something that just that misleads people, which is talking about Avodah Zarah. That whole perek in Yumi, it's perek Yud, is talking about the foolishness of Avodah Zarah, how goyim make themselves statues and they beautify them in all kinds of ways, and they think they're going to bring down Hashpah Milamayla with it, and nothing of the sort. There you also have, by the way, in that parak, we have the pasuk that we say in Krishma Shalamita, Kidna Temrun Lahoim, which is, it's the only pasuk in Nevi'im, which is in Aramaic. This is Yirmiyah telling the Jews in Bavel, when the Goyim in Bavel are asking you, why don't you worship Avodah Zarah like we do? You tell them that these gods are worthless. They didn't create the heavens and the earth, and they're going to be destroyed. And then throughout that parak, Yirmiyah is explaining to the Jewish people, the Goyim believe in their Avodah Zarahs, and they think there's reality to it, and there's nothing of the sort. So this is all part of that. So the over achas, there's this one thing that yivaru that caused them to be burnt in Gehenim, v'yichsaru, because they're foolish, musan habolim, etu, because they think they have to be taught havolim, which was something which is really foolishness, etu, and it's only wood and it's worthless. The Rambam, by the way, uses in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, explains this pasuk a little differently, more according to Pshat. We know, he says, that in the times of Enosh, people started making the mistake of thinking you have to worship the various natural forces, because Hashem put and gave them Memshala in the world, and therefore, like, you have to honor the ministers of a king, etc. So he uses this pasuk to explain, they're making the mistake. They think that you have to worship them, but it's really v'achas yivaru v'yichsolu. This is the one thing they're being foolish, that they think you have to worship these things, the intermediaries between us and Hashem, and really it's not so. Eitzu, it's nothing but a useless block of wood, because all of these things are only kagaz and v'yad achoitziv, and they have no independent power of their own. Maharsha actually points out that Reb Nachman realized, Reb Nachman knew to begin with, it is talking about Avodah Zarah. But again, he thought that vayivaru means to be foolish. So he thought that it's only one thing, only one kind of Avodah Zarah they're being foolish with. But what do you mean? There are lots of Avodah Zarahs over there. So Rabbi Yitzchak is explaining him, it doesn't mean one kind of Avodah Zarah. It means one basic type of Avera, which consigns them to Gehenna. In the sense that, as Ion Yaakov says, because we know the Gemara elsewhere says, a person denies Avodah Zarah, he's considered that he's accepted the validity of the whole Torah, and vice versa, if he accepts Avodah Zarah, he's denying the whole Torah, and therefore it can be called one thing that kicks a person out of Gan Eden and sticks him in Gehenna. So that's the one thing that the goyim wind up being foolish with, and therefore that's what Yirmiyah is warning the Jewish people: stay away from that. Lo ke'ela chelek Yaakov. He says you don't have your portion like that. You have your portion in Hashem. Stick to Hashem. Yirmiyah Mashiach Gola. Like Boimer, you're Tessier. In Yemos Mashiach, when it's Ruach HaTumah Avim in Aret, so Chazal say on that, and in Medrash Rabbah, in Kehelos Rabbah, when the Pasuk says, in Hazinu, Mochatzi Vani Erpa, literally it means I wound and I heal. But the Medrash understands, Mochatzi Moloshin Mechitza. I made a Mechitza between the upper and the lower world, that right now, the upper worlds, the things in the upper worlds between the Malachim and also the stars and planets and whatnot, they live forever, as we call it, Hayom and Be'ish, individually, they each continue to live forever, whereas the Tachtonim die. La'asid Lava, Hashem says, I'm going to remove that Mechitza, I'm going to heal and remove that Mechitza, it won't be necessary at all. So Reb Shimon by Yechoi, now, who was the one who revealed Pnimiyas HaTorah to us, was the one who was Mevaru, that Mechitza, so mainly it's going to be finished off La'asid Lava, but Rashbi already brought in it the greatest possible light, the Urash HaMashiach, so he began that process of breaking down that Mechitza. Continuing with Hilchos Shabbos, So speaking of mechitzas, actually, in a different sense, as far as the halachas of Shabbos, if you're making a mechitza on Shabbos to be matir something, then you're not allowed to put it up on Shabbos or Yom Tov. So an example would be, let's say that we know you're not allowed to have relations when there's light in the room. So now you have, let's say, you want to put a mechitza in front of it in order to be able to, in front of Sfarim, because you can't have Sfarim in the room either. So you're not allowed to do such things on Shabbos. That would be like making an oil. What you can do is you can cover them with two covers, one on top of the other. That's not making an oil. So the basic idea would be that when you're making an oil to be matir or something, then you can't do that. On Shabbos. And then we'll continue. We'll learn more about such dinim tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. Another example of it would be a mechitza in shul. For example, if the mechitza was not partially open before Shabbos, then you wouldn't be able to put it up on Shabbos for the same reason, because you can't daven there without a mechitza.
just need a room and you want to make the room wider.
If you want to make the room wider, then you're not putting up a mechitza. Then you're taking it down, if anything. But that's, yeah, I mean, that you can't. No. So if you're just using it to make the room wider with pashtus, you're not doing it in order to be matu anything. So that might be allowed. But if you're using it because without it, there's something in halacha that you can't do, then you can't put up or take down such a mechitza on Shabbos.
Because you should see them, not because you have needed under the shoes.
Oh, okay. So then a correction to what I just said then, Rabbi Elzebe, is saying that when it's a mechitza in shul between the men and the women, it's not so much that you need a separate reshus, it's just practically speaking, you need to prevent the men and women from seeing each other doing davening, so such a thing you might be able to put up on Shabbos, as opposed to, for example, what we're saying is, for example, when there's a light or sfarim in the room, in a bedroom or whatever, that's different, because the point is to make a separate reshus for them, and that you can't do on Shabbos.
Yeah.